Good evening, everyone. This is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. And I hope you can understand me okay. We just returned from the trip to London and France, and I got an allergy when I was in France. There's something there that didn't like me. So it ended up with a sore throat, and it went up into my sinuses, which didn't do very well because I had to do a class. But so I just hope you'll be able to understand me okay. All right. Let me give out the 800, the toll-free number, in case anyone wants to call in. But we're going to be talking tonight about our class and about the trip, and we had a lot of interesting things happen on the trip. So, Julie's here. She just walked in. So
I'm here.
He's ready to go, too. Okay, the toll-free number, in case anyone does want to call in, is 1-888-815-9756. 1-888-815-9756. We've been gone over 2 weeks.
A little over 2 weeks, 15 days.
Yeah.
Don't exaggerate.
Well, that's what Don said. He thought we were going to be back. So that's why he just took a chance to call anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we've been over in England and France, and it's been very interesting. I guess we could just start at the beginning anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. But if I'm coughing, and that's what it is. It's that allergy I picked up. All right. Well, we went to London, and we had a very good lecture. There was over about 200 people there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that turned
really
out
nice.
Really well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were off to a really good start. I had a book signing in London, and then we went to the lecture.
Yeah, that book signing was at Watkins Bookstore. We want to plug them because they were fantastic. They're wonderful people.
And they said they're really going to be selling my books in England and pushing all of this. So if you are in England, check out Watkins Bookstores, and they are carrying all of my books. Okay, but there's one thing I did want to bring up that did happen at the London lecture right afterwards. You know, people are always coming up and talking to us. And was right at the end, this woman came up in a wheelchair. And, of course, you know, everybody always wants a session. And, you know, I try to please as many people as I can. But when you're on a trip and you're traveling and you're doing lectures and classes, it's just impossible.
Well, but what people don't realize is how long your sessions take and the energy they take and everything. Your sessions run 4 to 5 hours. That's hard to carve out of a day when you have a lot of other things happening. So.
And our energy is going toward the lectures and the classes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, this woman was in a wheelchair, and she was talking to me, and she said she had cancer, and she had it in many parts of her body. Well, as I've said on the show before, we do know that cancer, the majority of the cases are caused by anger, and it's suppressed anger. It's anger that people don't want to let out. They hold it inside. Now, if they could just talk to somebody, it would make a big difference, but they don't. Instead of taking anger, I guess, out on the person, I don't know if that'd be any good or not, they hold it inside. They usually say things like, I don't have any problems, you're the ones with the problems. But they hold it in, and after a while, that anger has got to find release. So it begins to turn around and eat away at the organs, and this is one of the main causes that we have found of cancer. So that's one of the first things I asked her, were you angry at anything or anybody? And she said, no, I can't be angry anymore. I figured out that's what it was, and I can't be angry anymore because I saw what it was doing to me. She said she had forgiven the person. I don't know if it was in person or if she did it mentally. We always say you have to forgive and release or you're not going to get rid of it. She said she'd already forgiven the person, but still the cancer was there. But then as Julia began talking to her, we found out, here's something I think you should think about. Yeah, you forgive the person and release it because you can understand the cancer was being caused by the anger. But then she turned the anger in on the disease. she's no longer angry at the person who made her cause the cause of the whole thing. She forgave them, released them, but then now she's angry at the disease. That's still anger in one form or another. And that's when Julie had a talk with her because she's really good at, she picks up a lot of things. And you want to tell them what you were saying to
her? Sure, because it was really interesting. I saw this as like a little entity sitting there. It was like it kind of showed me that she had created this little entity called cancer out of her anger, and that's where her anger was focused was on that little guy. You know, I mean, it just showed itself as a little guy to me, but it was actually in her body, you know. So, I mean, however that, whatever you want to make of that.
Symbolism.
But, right. So, because we don't want anybody thinking, oh, there's entities or there's attachments or anything. It's nothing like that. It's just that's how it represented itself
to me. It's a symbol.
Right. And then it was like, well, and then it came to me that you need to hug this little guy. You know, you need to hug it and embrace it. And through that, it was by embracing it, you know, it's like it's taught you things. And embracing it, you will learn what it's taught you and then love it. It was just like it was so important to just love this thing. And what it said is you hug it and you love it to death. And that was the big thing. It was like, and I saw her hugging and hugging and hugging, I saw it just dissipate. It just disappeared. And that was like very, very important, was to fully integrate, and I'm getting all the confirmation chills, fully understand and integrate why it was there and what it was there to teach her. And then she starts saying, well, you know, I have learned how to be a healer since I've had this, and I've learned this. And she started naming off all these things she was learning, and it was like, see, that's embracing it for what it is.
But it was teaching her.
Yes.
It's always teaching you something.
Absolutely. And so that's what you've got to do, is embrace it and acknowledge it. I mean, the fact, you know, if you just keep resisting it and fighting it and hating it and being mad at it, it's just, you know, it's not, you're just building it. So
you're giving it energy and making it stronger,
right.
Really.
But because anything you resist persists. But by embracing it and learning from it and loving it, then it fulfills its purpose and it was able to go. And so
this was a new thing that we hadn't thought of before, because I have lots of people coming to me with cancer, and we have them coming from all over the world. And we did know about the anger part, but we didn't think about them turning it in and hating the disease.
Right, and then you needing to love the disease for what it's taught you, because that's the other part. The disease is a thing all its own.
Yes.
Yeah, you have this other stuff going on. So see, this is multifaceted in this multidimensional world. Great, we got all these multis, but you have the anger that was going on with the situations and the people or whatever, and then you turn that in. Because you're angry, you're not releasing it. All that's coming in on yourself, and then you also have this creation that you make because of the anger. And so, see, it's like, that's why anger is just so...
It's destructive.
very, very
destructive.
Yeah, I mean, it's a force, and if you don't... I mean, that's what you're talking about, the power of us, of the power we have to create. I mean, you create that. It's out of energy, so.
Well, before we left, a few months before, I had two other women who had cancer throughout their body. And it was so bad, you know, the doctors say, well, we don't even know where to start, you know, because there's nothing we can do. But there was one, I just want to say something. She had, was a live-in, I guess it was a partner, a man she'd been living with for something like 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, he decided to leave. Well, of course, that broke her heart. You know, she'd been with him so long, and I don't remember the details of it, but when she left, he left, she was just heartbroken, and she was grieving, and she said many, many times, I want to die. I just want to die. Well, be careful what you say, because, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. And she developed the cancer throughout her whole body.
And there was probably anger there, too.
Oh, you probably anger at him. How could he do this?
And then anger at herself for being duped. essentially, you know. So yeah. There's a lot of anger that can go around there, and then the wish to die. So
yeah, because she was hurt so bad. Probably the anger. How could he do this to me after devoting so much to my life to
Right,
me?
Right.
And then it was, you know, I just want to die. Well, then when she discovered the cancer, she came to me and she said, "Well, I've changed my mind. I don't want to die anymore. But I just want you to be very careful of your thoughts and what mm-hmm. you say, because these are examples we get all
right.
the time from people."
Well, and these are times, I mean, you know, even 10, 20 years ago, we were in a different world.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
we've always been creating our realities, but now we're creating at just lightning speeds. And like that, see, 20, 50 years ago, if she would have done that, it would have popped up a whole lot. It would have taken longer for her to create, where now, see, she created
it
pretty
quick. It would
have
showed itself
so.
Slower in
right.
other ways. This
mm-hmm.
came on very fast.
Right. So,
I think Julie's right. Things are manifesting much faster, and we have to be careful what we put out there.
Well, it's to show you. It's to show us how strong we are and how powerful we are, and so that... And you do have control. You know, it's like, I just thought this and it happened. Okay, I'm going to watch my thoughts. I'm going to watch my words. I'm going to watch. You know, this is where you become very conscious about it. And you have to become conscious in order to create consciously, well, of course,
mm-hmm, yeah.
but to create the world that you want.
But
otherwise, I mean, you're creating all the time, but this is how you realize it. So
you start paying attention to mm-hmm. what you're creating.
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting thing that happened. But then, after the lecture, we did our class. And both of the classes we did in England and in France, there was an interesting thing about them. The one in England, there were very few English people in it.
Well, yeah, there were some. But we did that one in Oxford. What was the name of the city?
Barrington.
Barrington, yes.
It was out by Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Outside
beautiful,
of,
beautiful area. It's gorgeous.
Outside of
mm-hmm.
London. But in that class, we had a class for 40 people. What they were coming, we know they were from Switzerland.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, we had from Bulgaria, from Romania, Malta, and where was that? I just went blank.
Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
But it seemed like they were from everywhere.
Yeah, it was a very diverse group.
Yes.
Very.
And the same thing in France. They were
mm-hmm.
from all over
mm-hmm.
Holland. There's several from Switzerland. Some of them, that one young man backpacked all the way from Holland.
Right, right.
To get there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there was hardly any French in that one.
Right, I think there were three. Well, there was a few from France there. So
yeah. They were just mm-hmm. coming from, and we had a woman in the French class that came all the way from New York.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that they're coming from so far. But with my problems with accents, I was deluged, I guess, by every kind of accent you could think of on this whole trip.
That's where I come in.
She's my translator, because when I'm doing the lectures or the classes, I said she has to translate the English.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to talk in slang, and they look at you kind of strange. Some of the terms we use, they haven't heard at all. So the class was very interesting. So then we go back to London, and we had one day off before we
went. Well, you're making like we went back to London after France. We went to London after the class in
okay,
Farringdon.
I'm talking after the
mm-hmm.
class
mm-hmm.
in Farringdon,
mm-hmm.
out by Oxford. We
yeah.
did the English class first. Mm-hmm. Then we went back to London for a well-deserved day off.
Right.
And we had planned ahead of time. We wanted to do something just for us. So we decided to go down into the theater district,
mm-hmm.
and we had already made a reservation to see a play.
Mm-hmm.
And I always liked the musicals, so we decided to see Wicked.
And it was wonderful. In fact, I was just listening to the CD coming up.
Okay. But, you know, we'd said, heard about it before, but we just never had time to go and see it. So this time we made the reservation to see Wicked and give ourselves a treat. Those of you who don't know what it's about, it was the story of before the Wizard of Oz, that before Dorothy came into the picture, about the two witches.
Yeah, it's kind of like the backstory, you know. It's
they
like
call
the other
prequel, or
right?
Whatever.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm.
about the Wicked Witch, and then there was always Glinda. Mm-hmm. She was the Good Witch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the Wizard of Oz, but this is the story of how they came to be before mm-hmm. they were considered
right.
wicked.
Right.
And it was a very interesting the way they turned it around.
Yeah, don't spoil the plot for anybody who wants to see it, because it is, I just absolutely loved it. I mean, it was just so fascinating, and it was just...
But I will say it had a very good ending.
Yeah, but don't spoil it
for
people that haven't seen it.
Not at all
what
people would have thought.
Right, I loved it. I loved what they did. I loved whoever wrote that, whoever came up with that, I love them, because it's just, I love how they did that. It was just, it's like a redeeming thing, you know, so.
You said it was, they were more metaphysical.
There were metaphysical things all through that, and I'm just sitting there going, oh my gosh, do they realize what they're saying? And I thought, well, they have to.
And the lyrics to the music.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've been listening, and it's not as much there as I thought it was. It was more in the talking than, apparently, because that's what I've been listening for. But there are some, but nothing like what I was... I mean, it was a lot of their talking parts.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just... Because they were talking about people being asleep, and now they're waking up. And, I mean, things like that, you know, just even that. Those are
uh-huh.
little things. So.
But it had wonderful music. It was funny.
Mm-hmm.
Had wonderful special effects.
Mm-hmm.
They had lighting. They had things coming from the ceiling. And
right.
The flying monkeys that were there, Wizard
right.
of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
They had lots of costumes and coming down from the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
on little, well, she comes down on a circle.
Oh, yeah, Glinda.
Yeah.
And her bubble.
her bubble.
Uh-huh. And they had well, Alphaba, who's the Wicked Witch of the West, they had her and her broom and everything. So,
but it was very clever, very entertaining, and they're saying it's supposed to be the number one hit musical
mm-hmm.
right now
yeah.
in the world.
Yeah.
So there probably are places in the United States you can go to see it. Julie's daughter, Tiffany, saw it in Dallas.
Yeah, if you get a chance to see it, go see it. It's fantastic.
Because we don't know if the ones in the States are as good as the ones in London.
I bet they are, because they have a reputation, but it's the storyline everything was fantastic. Their performances are outstanding, but I couldn't believe the story. I was so excited about the story. You know, that's what I was just... jumping out of my seat about, was like, oh my gosh, look what they did.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So anyway, it was a very delightful
mm-hmm.
evening to
yeah.
get away from work to go to London Theater.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And see something really good. Then we were going to try to get to France.
Dum, dum, dum.
There we ran into problems.
Yeah. It just wasn't.
We got an email from the woman who was bringing, we were going to the south of France. Down by Avignon. The only time I've ever been to France was a few years ago when we went to an ashram outside of Paris. But this is way down in the south of France, around by Avignon. So we were supposed to do that. We had all our arrangements made. We were going to take the tunnel, which is the train underneath underneath the water,
right.
going from London and coming up in Paris. We already had our train tickets to go by train down
mm-hmm.
to Avignon.
Mm-hmm.
And we got an email that night before that said that the trains had gone on strike.
Right. They were going to go on strike on the day we were leaving.
That day,
yeah.
that next day.
Uh-huh.
And so they suggested that we get a plane. At the last minute, it's pretty expensive to get a plane. So we went ahead and booked a plane instead. So we go to the airport, then we
bright and early in the morning.
Real early. Then we find out that the aircraft controllers in France were also on strike
mm-hmm.
that day. They said they like to strike in France.
Mm-hmm.
They all went on at the same time. We said, now what are we going to do? And the one at the counter says, well, we can get you to Avignon on Friday. I mean, we were going
Marseille,
to Marseille.
Yeah,
we had
Marseille.
To take the,
mm-hmm.
but they were taking the train to Avignon. We were going to take the plane. It was going into Marseille,
right?
Which was in the general vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
We can get you to Marseille on Friday. That's not going to work because my class is going to start on Friday. So we got to get there before then. So she found another plane that evening, that was going to go to Toulouse, which
mm-hmm.
was really further away.
Right.
but it was the only way to get there. So we went ahead and booked that. We sat in the airport in London all day long.
Yep.
With our suitcases.
Everybody knows how much fun that is.
We had all our suitcases. We couldn't turn anything in for a couple of hours before the flight.
Right.
So, you know, that's very boring. You're
well,
sitting...
we had gotten up so early, too. We were tired.
So that night, after we got later and later, we watching the clock. Finally, we said, okay, it's in 2 hours in bed. Now we can go and get our luggage checked in order to get on the plane. Then we find out that flight has been canceled.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize. That's this pollen that's still in my throat. Okay. So that flight had been canceled. And we found out why later, because we had the one email from the woman who was bringing this in, and she said they were expecting a terrible storm that evening, and it was called a red storm. And we said we didn't know what a red storm was, but we thought it didn't sound very good.
Right.
But we had already told her we were coming into Toulouse, so she was on her way there.
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to get a hold of her and tell her that flight's been canceled. But we found out it was canceled because of the storm. And it was the next day when we got there that we found out that it was a terrible storm. They said the worst in 80-something years.
Yeah, and it was flooding, and it was really bad.
Torrential rain. Mm-hmm. So naturally, the planes weren't going to fly, so that was the reason why.
Right.
By that time, after sitting there all day, and I know you guys out there who have done this can identify it, we was going to go back to the gate.
Because before when it was canceled, they said go to the desk and talk to them about it, and they'll reschedule you. We went back down there. We just went downstairs and we saw the desk, and there was at least 100 people in line, and we're like,
all trying to get rebooked.
Mm-hmm.
So we said no. We were wore out by that time. So thank goodness for the computers and the internet.
Yeah, that's when we realized I had my laptop with me, and we're like, hey, we can get on it and book another flight that way. And,
yeah, thank goodness for the internet.
And we did. Booked a flight on a different airline.
It was leaving the next morning.
Right. And then we also booked us a hotel and got out of there. So get us some sleep.
We had to get some sleep anyway. So we got a little bit. I think we had to get up about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that seems to be our time anymore.
To get back to the airport, to get the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And you kept trying to get a hold of her to tell her, don't go to the airport, but she was already on her way.
She was already on her way, but I was trying all kinds of things. If anybody could intercept her, you know, call her and let her know. And
we found out
with the storm, all of her phones were out. And then she was already on the way, but, yeah, the phones were out, and then the internet was the only way to communicate, but she was on the road, so she couldn't get the internet. So I was like, you know.
So anyway, after all of that, we were sitting in the airport. We kept thinking, maybe we're not supposed to go to France. With all the strikes, the trains, and the aircraft controller, maybe we're not supposed to go.
Well, if the flight the next morning would have canceled, that would have been our message, but... You know, because that was like, okay, we're not supposed to go. But it was just that day we weren't supposed to go, apparently.
But now we know the storm and everything, it would have been dangerous.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the rest of the time, the weather was beautiful.
It was gorgeous. It was gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous weather. So
we got on the plane, get to Marseille, and we're picked up. We arrived very weary travelers at where they were living. We were staying with these people. Way out in the country.
Yeah, it reminds us of home.
The same kind of mountains,
right.
A lot of woods.
Mm-hmm.
And out in the country, they had over 150 or more year old farmhouse.
Yeah, but it was nice. It's very nice. It's not like a farmhouse over here.
No, made out of stone.
Yeah. Yeah, we wouldn't call it a farmhouse. I'm not sure what we would call it, but it wouldn't be a farmhouse. So.
But she said it hadn't been too long that they had had electricity and water put into it.
Right. Well, she's done a lot of. They've done a lot of nice work on it. It was very nice. So.
One problem was their road Now, people always talk about our dirt roads up here where we live. And I said, compared to that road, our roads look like a highway.
Yeah.
Because the rain didn't help, because it had huge ruts and holes in it. It was only one lane wide. But it was a long dirt road getting up to their house.
Oh, the driveway.
The driveway. Yeah. But anyway, the road was made ours look good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it did. That's not easy to do, is that right?
Okay. Well, a lot of people talk about our road being bad. It's really not. And out there, they don't have the graders that come out and work on the roads like we do.
Yeah, so we're very appreciative of our, we have a county department that does that, takes care of our roads, even though we gripe about them all the time, but, you know, or when they don't get out here often enough, so.
So anyway, we got there, and we had plans. I had 2 days. That was supposed to be my day off, and the next day before I started up in with my classes. And I had plans of things I really wanted to see when I was down there. So that day, after we went to bed, took some nap, and was feeling like we could go again, we wanted to go to Ceylon, which was down right there, very, very close, and see the home of Nostradamus. Because I looked it up on the internet, and that was where the Nostradamus Museum was in Ceylon. And after writing 3 books about him, and I knew a great deal about him, I really wanted to see where he lived. So that was the thing we did. And as soon as we were able to get him after we took a nap and we were able to go, Francois took us into Ceylon. And after much hunting around, we found him.
Right, yeah, we're following signs. We knew roughly where it was. We just had to start walking. But you could feel, it was just so funny, because the both of us, we were walking down the street, and all of a sudden we're going, we're getting close. We could feel it.
Very narrow street, looked like from hundreds and hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, but we knew we were there. And then all of a sudden we looked, and we're standing right in front of it. It's like, oh, okay.
But it was a funny feeling, like, yeah, we're close.
Mm-hmm.
And you could feel the energy going through your body.
Yeah. And then it stopped.
When we got to the museum.
Yeah, it was in the streets. When we got to the museum, it stopped. It wasn't there. It was like, I'm sure it was the place, but I was in my mind, it's even questioning, was that even the place?
They say it was his home.
Okay.
And they turned it into a museum.
Okay.
But the energy is they have really spoiled it. Well, the doors, even when you go in,
they weren't right.
They had put in big glass doors, so it looked to us like they had gutted the entire inside of the house and made it into like a museum. The whole downstairs, you know, selling souvenirs.
Yeah, I was really hoping that it was going to be his home, and it was kind of left
the way
it was, and then and you could see it, but it was instead done as an honorarium to him, which is nice. That's great that he is honored and he is remembered. And so they had all of his things that he was doing and everything. But when the way they did it, it was just that it had nothing of him there. He was gone.
There was a mannequin, like a wax dummy, sitting at a desk right when you walked in. But then they had the souvenirs and things. And I know that that house was much larger.
It must
have been much more to it.
Mm-hmm.
But from the downstairs, in a spiral staircase going up 3 floors, because it was a 3-story house, so you had to walk up that, and on each floor they had some things about him. They had the recording.
Kind of a history, just as when he was a young boy learning from his great-grandfather.
His grandfather,
okay.
And all the history of him, and then showing it showed him in his study writing, but none of it, and it also had another floor, they had a wax dummy of Catherine de' Medici, the queen of France. It had the story of his life.
Right, it was a timeline. That's what I'm saying, it was an honorarium to him. It was like, that kind of a thing, but it would have been nice to have, that's what I was hoping for, is to see his home, because I had a vision of it, and I was wondering if it was what it was going to be. And
yeah, and in my books, we had a lot of details about it, what it was like.
Right.
But, over, 500 years,
yeah,
There might have been other people who lived there. A lot of their things were taken away, so they probably didn't have anything left anyway. Because I didn't see anything, really, that was actually his. There might have been a few things down on that first floor. But it was the feeling like the only thing that was genuine would have been the walls of the building, the stone walls as you went up the staircase. But you did have one feeling in one place.
And that was on the ground floor, and it was right at this one doorway before you go into the room where you start going up the stairs. And it was just right at that. And that's the only place I felt something there, and it just kept saying, go upstairs, because I was like, that's... And when we went to the very top, that's where his room was, his study. So I'm guessing, see, that would have been the closest thing to the real thing, because everything else... Well, that's not how it was. You know, none of the other stuff was the way it was. But that study, all the way got up there, was just a little small room. And in my vision, he had bookshelves completely lining the wall, and they just had one little bookshelf. You know, it was like they just had a little bitty thing. And it was a much bigger room than that. It had books everywhere and tables and stuff. You know, it's everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Because he was a very messy person.
Yeah.
The story we have.
Yeah. And so, but I think, but that... But at least they had a room. And so it was like that was the closest to any of the real stuff.
Yeah.
So.
But other people have told me, too, when they've gone there, that he wasn't there. They didn't feel him.
Yeah.
But anyway, I got to see it. And
I felt him in the street as we were coming up there, because that's how we knew we were getting. It
yeah.
was just, you could feel it. You knew we were close, and it was an excitement. And that's where the energy was. Well, you know, because
that
all of
that
he would walk
old.
Those streets all the time. So.
And all of that is still like it was.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it was an interesting experience that we took pictures, and now we can say we saw where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, we also were going to take a day off, and I wanted to go to Saint Marie de la Mar, because I'd written about that, and that was also very close. And I don't want to go too much into the story, but it has to do with Jesus and the crucifixion. And after the crucifixion, when they put all of the disciples and the Marys, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Mary Salome, and Lazarus, there were about 100 people. They put them all on a boat and put them out into the Mediterranean. They wanted to kill them all, Joseph of Arimathea, but they couldn't kill them, especially because Joseph was such a rich and powerful man. They said, let's put him out on the ship out into the Mediterranean. No sails and no oars. Let the sea kill him. But by a divine miracle, which I think should be in the Bible, I think it should be taught to people, they came ashore there on the coast of France.
Well, to put it in the Bible, they'd have to acknowledge that there were female disciples, though.
Yeah.
So there's the conundrum.
Yeah. But anyway, they came ashore there, and at that place is where they have built this church, and there's a grotto down underneath it. I'm going to be writing some more about this, because I have regressions in my very beginning of my work where they went to that part, because that's where the gypsies go every year for their reunions and their gatherings. And they would go down into the grotto underneath the church, because there's a statue under there of the servant. Sarah was the black servant of the Marys and took care of them. And so Sarah is the patron saint of the gypsies. So we wanted to see this, because to see if it went along with the stories I've heard and the stories that I found in my work. Now, that was interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was.
That church is the only big thing in the whole town. It's just a little village.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You can see that church everywhere.
Miles away, as you're coming in, you can see that church.
See, Saint Marie de la Mar means St. Mary's of the Sea. And in there, well, when you go in the church has done a lot of, what do you want to call it, changing the legends. You can tell that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the paintings and in the statues, they have the two Marys, Mary Magdalene and Mary Salome, standing in a little bitty boat, just like it was only two of them. They have an angel watching over them.
Mm-hmm.
Like those two were the only ones that made it there. not thinking there was a whole boat full of people.
That made a better story. Made more of a miracle story.
The two women survived the seas and made it there. So all the pictures just show the two women in this little boat, and so that part was exaggerated. But anyway, it's just a very small church. So we went down into the grotto, and there they have the statue.
I don't know about small. Not a small church.
Considering cathedrals we've been in.
Oh, well, okay. Well, it was very tall.
Oh, yeah.
that ceiling was huge.
I never could figure out why they have such tall, tall ceilings. But they were saying that it means ascending, I guess.
You can ascend. It gives you room to ascend.
But we went down into the grotto, and we were told that whenever the gypsies come, and the candles are all down there, it's so hot that you can't stay.
Well, it was hot down there, and there were candles, but nothing like what they said whenever they do their whole thing. And they said it gets so hot, the candles are bending over and everything, and melting.
Uh-huh. And there was the statue of the black servant, Sarah. Mm-hmm. And got pictures of that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it was very interesting, the whole story. And you could see how the church went and embellished it and changed it around to fit their requirements. But in the booklet we got about the church, it was interesting because they said one of the most important things about what happened there, their story is that after they landed, Mary Magdalene went into France and formed a church and went to preach the gospel. Well, she did form the second church was in France. The first one was the people who landed. They got a better boat and went to England and formed the first church at Glastonbury. The second one was formed there in France by Mary Magdalene. And the third was by Lazarus in Spain. Long, 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 hundreds and hundreds of years before the one in Rome was even thought about. But they did say in the booklet that something people should always remember was that the church began by women disciples.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they also acknowledged that there were more people on that boat than what the picture said.
Yeah.
So that was supporting everything that you had gotten.
Yeah, in the little booklet.
Right.
But it makes a better story if they just had the picture of them.
Absolutely.
But they said it must be remembered that the women are the ones who started the church, and it started in France. Of course, that's, you know, it started in England.
Right.
But Lisa, they also said in the little booklet, it must give credit to the fact that there were women disciples.
Right, yeah.
Now, I don't know what the official Catholic of the Pope has to say about all of that, but it's interesting to go and see these things.
Mm-hmm.
But you know me, I like to research and I like to find these things out. There'll be another book where I'm going to go into all of this more.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fascinating. Even on the one wall, they had a replica of the Shroud of Turin.
Right.
So those 2 days were really interesting, and I got to see what I really wanted to see. Then we had to go to work.
Yep.
And we had our 3-day class. And the class was held in a 1,000-year-old monastery. It was near the farm where we were at.
Right.
Huge monastery, beautiful, big.
Yeah.
Looked like a castle sitting on top of a hill.
Mm-hmm.
And their monks were walking all around in the white robes. And I kept wondering, do they know what we're teaching here?
The answer to that is no.
They just let us have our class.
No, they knew you were doing a healing class, which is exactly what you were doing.
Okay.
But they didn't know everything, you know, like all of the aspects of it, what you were doing. But
we don't want to rock the boat.
They were fine. You were teaching healing.
Yeah.
Because
we talked to the one monk. But then they had the meals there. And otherwise, it's a typical monastery, but it was really very nice.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
And
they were very nice people, too.
They are. It's interesting to have a class in a 1,000-year-old monastery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have these classes everywhere. interesting where we show up.
And they asked, did I ever have a class in there before, you know, the monastery. I have spoken at a convent with nuns. I have had lectures there.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted the money read out the hall.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But I've never done it with the monastery before. But I have to talk about the one thing that really upset me with France.
and that's just your problem with adjusting and adapting to where you are.
I know. Julie always says, when in France, do as the French do. Mm. We travel a lot, and you have to get used to the customs. But I was not prepared for this. They're very laid-back people. They take their time. They're beautiful, wonderful people. But we found out that, what is it, around noon?
Noon to 2. Noon to 2, everything shuts down.
They take their lunch.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In Spain, they would call it a siesta. But in France, they shut everything down, and they have a two-hour or longer
lunch. Businesses and stores, all it's all shut, closes down, and that's when you go be with your family, and you have lunch. And the lunch is the biggest meal. That's the most important meal.
And it has several courses.
Mm-hmm, 3 courses.
And so they said, I didn't know this, because when I do my class, I break about noon, 12:30, for lunch, and we usually allow an hour,
mm-hmm.
an hour and a half if they have to go away to find restaurants. I was expecting it to be the same as it is in the States, not over there. They have their 3 courses, and they take a long time eating them and serving them. It doesn't do much for our hectic way of life. I told them I'd never work in the States, but they said that's what it is over there. They let everybody goes home, and they all eat together with their family and with their children. I guess schools stops
maybe.
Too, and they all
maybe.
Come home. And they said, don't you think this is a better way to live? It's more laid back. It's more relaxing to spend time with your family. And then you go back to work. I said, well, we have to work an 8-hour day. They said, they do.
Yeah, they come back at 2, and they do 4 hours from 8 to noon, and then 2 to 6. So they do an 8-hour day. They just have that 2-hour break in there.
And I said, well, I guess it would be make more sense if we did something like that, more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
There wouldn't be as much high blood pressure or heart problems or nervousness, mm-hmm. anxiety or depression or all of that if we could do something like mm-hmm. that. I still don't think it would work here.
Well, you'd have to change. It would work. You have to adopt it. Now, if you're someone and you're trying to make it work, and everybody around you and where you work is not doing that, well, yeah, that's going to be difficult. You're going to run into some bumps and stuff, but things would change. But I think the country could be served by doing that, to just relax a little bit, you know, maybe just for that, you know, just having that
nice
lunch.
One thing, reason it wouldn't work is that the people don't live in the city.
Right.
Where the jobs are.
Well, and like you said, an analogy was, okay, mom's over here working, dad's over here working, the kids are at school, who's going to get together for lunch, you know?
They said they do. They make it work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we did. As we were driving, you know, like even on the weekends and stuff, families were together a lot. They did a lot of things together.
Uh-huh.
So
they have found a way of life that works. It was hard on me, though, because I kept thinking, we got to get back to the class. I've got so much I have to cover in one day. And they were taking their time. Oh, the second, I thought the first course was it. That was the meal.
The starter.
No, that's the beginner. We have another course coming, but it takes us time getting there.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them, well, you know, in the States, if they took so long serving you, they'd be fired. And they said, not over there. They'd be fired if they rushed you, because you're supposed to be very relaxed and taking your time, taking as long as you want.
Right.
But I'm watching the clock. It took a lot longer to get back to the class after 3 courses, the dessert and all of that. Because all of that, and still they want to stop the class on time.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to teach what you have to teach?
Talk faster.
A shorter amount of time.
Talk faster.
But Julie kept saying, when in France, do as the French do.
Mm-hmm.
It is a more laid-back way. And then when we get back to the farmhouse for supper, they don't start eating till about 8.
Yeah, but because he was cooking. He was cooking a full-fledged dinner, but we didn't even get back there until, remember, it was after 6. So
the time we finished all
yeah.
what we were doing.
So, of course, it's going to be that late. So.
And 8 o'clock, we're eating, and we don't get to bed. They don't get finished eating until 10 o'clock.
Right, because, again, you have it's very relaxed. Everybody enjoys their conversation, enjoys, you know, socializing. So, and it's very nice, actually, you know. But they would have kind of courses, too, not as officially, but they were kind of, because when we came out there and they had the cheeses and the breads, that would be a starter, and then they were serving their meal. And then they had a dessert, so they had 3 courses again, you know, so.
Even my class, they kept wanting their tea breaks, and their tea breaks were not short.
Yeah, I think we should have tea breaks here. If nothing else, we should have tea breaks. With England and there, I get to ride, I just really love tea breaks.
Anyway, we've learned a lot of all this traveling. I know in Spain, when I've been there, I haven't done a class there yet, but they're the same way. Everything shuts down while they're having their siesta, which is just a time to relax, really.
Yeah, same thing.
So we're learning as we go. So we were asking Francois a lot about the country, and we're getting to find out a lot of things over there, too. One thing I didn't know, since most of Europe now was on the euro, they are becoming what they called one united Europe. They said, just like the United States, now it's united Europe.
Well, he said it was like we have the United States of America, he called it the United States of Europe. And I questioned him, is it really called that? And he's like, yeah, as far as I know.
We're passing along correct information. But he said, now in Europe, you don't need your passports to go from country to country.
Right, because it's united. Yeah, so you just be like being over here. You can go. You get checked when you come in, and then you're fine.
You come into Europe.
To Europe.
When you come into France. And after that, just like here, we don't have to stop every time we go across a border of a state. They said the same way there. You can drive, you can take the trains.
Yeah.
And
right, so they're, it's very similar.
They don't check the passports as you go from place to place. So that's a big change, that and the money.
Right.
England is still the only holdout that I know of over there. They will not give up their pound. They're holding on to that by tooth and nail.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the one united Europe and the euro is kind of taking things away from them. But I can see why they feel that way. They have been, look, over centuries, they controlled the world. A huge power, England was, and so they're not about to give it up yet. And I guess that pound gives them one less thing that's theirs and it's different.
Yeah.
So they're still holding on to that. But we find out a lot of these things, too, about the United Europe, and they'll have to use the passports to make it easier now if we go over there and go from country to country.
Right.
Which, you know, we never know where we're going to end up next.
And we did get to finally get on a train back up to, where did we go? We went from Avignon, to Paris. We took the train to Paris.
Yeah, we just were on the way back. We had it worked out. We found we get a train from Avignon directly into the airport.
Into the airport, and then you just go up the elevator, and there you are, and you just get on the plane. So.
This time we didn't have to sit there and wait all day.
But
we had to
That's another thing we need. We need tea breaks, and we need trains over here. Trains are good. So.
The train system in Europe is amazing. They're pretty much on time. You said when they had the strikes,
right? Yeah. So,
but they're wonderful modern trains, and they go everywhere because they said it would have taken 7 hours to drive to Paris,
right?
And this way, they were able to. We took a 3.5 train ride
into the airport,
and then 9 hours on the plane. We were really tired when we got
there. We
still
haven't seen the Eiffel Tower, though. We were trying to see it from the plane. I don't know where that thing is. Maybe it doesn't really exist. It's just in pictures. You know, it's not really there. So.
They say we're going in on the wrong side of Paris.
Well, it's that big. You should be able to see it from anywhere.
So anyway, we're coming around to the time again, but there's one other thing I want to bring up before we forget about it. We said in our classes we had people from coming in from all over the world, of Europe, which was amazing. Now, I think it was the England class.
It was. It was the England Level 2 class.
We had a man from Switzerland.
Right.
And he gave us some other, the more news that we found was different. You find out more things when you travel like this.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Everybody, travel more.
Well, you find out people are people. We're all alike.
That's right.
We're just people. Everybody looking for the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the man from Switzerland said, you know, we're always pushing alternative medicine and natural healing. We do that with my work, and I work with people all over the world who are into natural healing and alternative medicine.
Right.
So that's one thing I push. This man from Switzerland, they had a vote. It's been recently, I think.
Very recently.
It sounds like
maybe they do it every so often. It's kind of like how we do bills over here, and it's like it may have just been something to just kind of appease people or something, and they voted to see basically if people wanted alternative medicine.
As opposed or combined, wasn't it? It was supposed to be both. Did both alternative and regular medicine?
Well, they just wanted just to see if people are interested in alternative medicine.
Implicitly.
Right, as an option to have. And I guess before, it's always come up, it was under 50%, and so it was just, you know, they never gave it any attention, and they didn't have to do anything about it. But this time, it came up at 75% for it. And they were like, uh-oh. That meant that they were going to have to come up with protocol, because that meant people wanted it. They wanted alternative medicine, so they were going to have to come up with protocols then on what to do with it. And I said, that's their problem now, is trying to do that. And
he said they have to decide which kind of alternative medicine and natural healing would be the one that would be acceptable.
And then you have to have programs, and you have to have parameters, and you have to have, see, that's when they all come in and do their stuff. But
yeah, because there's so many different modalities.
Right.
Now they got to decide which ones they want to allow in and which ones they don't.
Right, and then someone, I think, was in the France class, said that they're really fighting it. So now it's really stirred up stuff. But I think the important message here is look at that as a barometer. Look at that as an indicator of what's happening around the world. And that may just be a precursor to what's getting ready to happen. You know, it's more, you know, people aren't, they're taking their power back is what's happening. So
and the more people, I keep telling people here, there's more people wanting the alternative medicine than they think.
Right.
The drug companies are really fighting to keep the drugs.
Yeah, they want you to think that, oh, yeah, this is what everybody wants. But no, I mean, that, you know, you don't have to believe everything you see and read and hear. I mean, that's just,
think for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was important that we heard that. You never would hear those things in the States.
No, no.
So we heard a lot of things when we're traveling that you would never find over here. Well, I think those are most of the notes I had. So we had a very interesting, exciting trip. And it's coming up to the hour again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's about all on that trip. I want to try to cover it all while it was still fresh in our minds.
Right, right. Well, the food was great. Tea breaks are great. Even though it was three courses, it was great food. Okay, you have to admit that.
It was good, and all home cooking.
They were going out in their yard and picking herbs off of the, you know, the bushes and using them. And I mean, they were just going out there and put, you know, like, I mean, you know, we've had gardens, but this was like even more so. I mean, they were just getting the herbs and they were making the tea and then they were putting herbs in the food, and they're making you thyme tea fresh from the thyme in their yard, you know.
From my sore throat, and it took it away.
Yes.
It was
fresh and natural as we could get. It was wonderful stuff. So,
no fast
food. So we thank you very much, Patricia and Francois and Hesha and everybody, if you're listening. So,
okay. All right, we're going to have to sign off now, and at least you know of our latest adventure and where we've been as we traipsed all over the world.
Right.
Okay. So good night, everyone, and thanks for listening.
Good night.